Electricity, a big idea that's inspired countless new ones. From powering the light bulb to virtually powering our entire lives. 30 years ago, State Street launched the Spider S&P 500 ETF, SPY. A big idea that inspired the world to invest differently. And still does. What can you do with SPY?
Before investing, consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Visit SSGA.com for a prospectus containing this and other information. Read it carefully before investing. SPY is subject to risks similar to those of stocks. All ETFs are subject to risk, including possible loss of principal. Alps Distributors, Inc. Distributor.
You're listening to The Exchange. Here's today's show.
Thank you, Scott, and welcome to The Exchange. I'm Deirdre Bosa, in for Kelly Evans, and here's what's ahead on our show. March CPI coming in hotter than expected. Yields are jumping, stocks are falling, and so is the probability for a June rate cut. But our market guest sees a lot of opportunities in both stocks and bonds. He's here to tell us where. Plus, NVIDIA is defying gravity, up nearly 2%. Amid today's market sell-off, our trader says what's going on is very strange, and he's here with how he is positioning. And Google unveiling a new chip and calling out the competition. You do not want to miss my exclusive interview with Google Cloud CEO Thomas Kurian. It is some of the strongest language we've heard from a Google executive in the AI race yet. But we begin with the markets and Dom Chu with the numbers. Dom.
All right, Dee, it's not a good day for the bulls out there. It's red across the screen, but we are, dare I say it, off the session lows. And here's what I mean. If you take a look at the Dow Industrials, we're down 430 points, roughly about 1% declines there. 38,455 is the last trade. The S&P 500, broader measure of large caps, 5160 is the last trade there, down roughly 50 points. Again, 1% declines. And to give you an idea of the range, it's been down all day. But even at the highs, we were down 31 points and down roughly 65 at the lows. There is your range. So again, tilting a little bit more towards the downside, but off the worst levels of the session for now. We'll see if that sticks. And the NASDAQ composite, the tech heavier index, maybe thanks in no small part to NVIDIA's outperformance today, is actually outperforming the rest of the indices, only off roughly 0.75%, 135 points to the downside, 16,169. If you want to look at the rate picture, it's the big story. The two-year note yield is seen as more of a proxy versus other parts of the yield curve on the bond market for that Fed interest rate hike or tighten model here. If you take a look over here, we did reach at one point the highest levels going all the way back to November of last year for that benchmark two-year note yield. So the Treasury complex and rates, very much a big focus. Speaking of that, the high-yield bond market, junk bonds, are not as levered to that rate story as investment-grade bonds are. But take a look at this ETF that tracks the high-yield bond market. It's been trading in a range for pretty much all year long. But today, we are testing the lower end of that range. So even with the rate picture, high yield is starting to see a little bit of stress. We'll see if these levels hold right now for junk debt. And then if you're looking for another place that's economically sensitive, check out what's happening with small cap stocks. This is the ETF that tracks the Russell 2000 small cap ETF. I've put up there this blue line, which represents the 50-day moving average price, an indicator of trend and momentum. Right now, trading just beneath it. We've tested it before over the course of the past several months, so we'll see if these levels hold. Watch small caps, watch junk debt. D, I'll send things back over
to you. Yeah, today's action raises questions for some of those smaller caps, Dom. Thank you very much. Let's get straight to that report that moved the markets and the rate cut probabilities. Steve Leisman has the headlines from this morning's CPI print. Steve, they're shifting yet again.
Yeah, this hot CPI report, you're getting a pretty cool reception in stocks and bonds where the chance of that near-term rate cut slipping away. If you want to look at this from a holiday standpoint, the market once had thought we'd get a first rate cut before Memorial Day. It's now only confident and maybe less so than it was before in a cut sometime after Labor Day. The June probability slipping 58% before the CPI number down to 20. July below 50%. September, well, you call that in play at 66%, down from darn near confidence at 92%. The January 2025 Fed Fund contract rose a sharp 25 basis points. That's almost precisely removing one rate cut from the 2024 outlook. Had been at 3. It's now pricing in actually under 50 basis points of easing this year. So just below the two rate cuts it had been priced in. Before that, it had priced in as much as 150 basis points. Of course, there are musings that if this continues, not only would the Fed not cut, but it may have to start thinking about hiking rates in order to coax inflation back to that 2% target. For now, that's still a long way away because the Fed generally views itself as restrictive. The current 5.38% rate is call it 280 basis points higher than the median long run or neutral rate of 2.6%. All that is to say, the Fed could and maybe even should cut where it is right now, but it won't in the face of stalling inflation progress. Best hope for the bulls is that this year mimics last year with high inflation early in the year, followed by some relaxation as the year progresses, Deirdre.
Right, and Steve, that had been the hope, right? That January and February had some seasonal effects, but
right.
Today's CPI number makes that case harder to make, right?
Right, there was one of the comments, one of the analysts out there said, you need two dots to draw a line and you need three dots to draw a trend. Well, we got that third dot today. That's the third trend. That's the third dot. And that shows inflation pretty much stalling out here, that progress. But look, if you look at last year, I think we had a chart there going back to January 2023. You'll see it was high. It came down. It's high now. Maybe it comes down as the year goes by.
Right. Steve Leisman, thank you very much. We're going to continue tracking the impact. And we've got 10-year sure. Treasury notes up for auction. Rick Santelli is tracking that action at the CME. Rick.
Deirdre, this was one nasty auction. Now, do keep in mind that we are up big on yields, whether it's the short end that's up over 22 basis points or our 10s that are up almost 19 basis points. We tried to auction off 39 billion 10s. And do keep in mind, this is a reopening. This is the second time we're adding into an original issue. And each time, each itineration sometimes gets a spidge weaker. So I gave this auction a D, and maybe that was kind, because 39 billion 10s came off at 4.56. Here's the problem. The when issued market at 1 Eastern, when it buttoned up, was basically 4.529. Let's call it 4.53. That means it tailed three full basis points. That is big. And as you look at the intraday chart, you can see clearly that yields moved up a bit on that. But it only wasn't pricing, which, as I said, on a reopening, you have to be a little more generous on your grading. But all the metrics were just nasty. 2.34 bid to cover. That's the worst since Dece of 22. 61.8 on indirects, the worst since October of 23. Directs at 14.2, weakest since November of 21. And if you look at the dealers, 24%. The 10 auction average is 15%. They ended up cleaning up a good chunk of the buffet on their own. That was the most the dealers have taken since November of 22. So no matter which way you go on this, the intermetrics, the pricing of the actual marketplace, or the fact that yields popped, yeah. I thought it could go either way. Sometimes big sell-offs are looked at as a concession when you're a buyer, but this time it was more about the fear of rates going even higher. Deirdre? Back
and
to you.
That's having an immediate impact on equities. Thank you, Rick. We're seeing the Dow at session lows off by about 550 points. The S&P 500 is off by about 1 1/3 of a percentage point. And the Nasdaq still holding up, but down again at session lows. Let's move on. One of my next guests is sticking with the June cut for now, even after today's CPI report. Joining me now are Matt Hornbach, Global Head of Macro Strategy at Morgan Stanley, Kevin Mahon, Chief Investment Officer at Henyon and Walsh. Gentlemen, thanks for being with me on set. Matt, I got to go to you first, because are you still expecting a June rate cut?
Well, I think our economists would tell you that this data point definitely causes risks to shift towards a cut later in the year, I think, is how they're framing it. And so while they're still sticking with that June rate cut, they do acknowledge that the risks clearly are pointing to a rate cut that is starts later in the year.
Okay. Kevin, I wonder if you can react to what we're seeing in bond yields, particularly that 10-year that seems to have had an impact on equities.
Yeah, I would start by suggesting that the path forward for three rate cuts this year, which the Fed confirmed just a couple weeks ago with their March star plot chart, still exists, with one potential rate cut at the end of July. They don't meet in August. They're not going to hike again in September because that might look too political with their last meeting before the election. They come back in November, cut one more time, 25 basis points, and perhaps one final cut of 25 basis points in December, getting us to those 75 basis points in cuts this year. I don't know if that's going to happen, but the path forward still exists. But regardless, I don't know when they're going to cut first, but rates are going to be lower over the next 3 years. And if rates, yields, and inflation are lower, that creates opportunities in both stocks and bonds, D.
Right. But, you know, the Fed is data dependent, right? Even if they factored that in, that could be changing with the latest numbers that we've had. How much weight do you put into these CPI numbers? The preferred metric is PCE, which we get at the end of the month. Do you think that, and we talked about this with Steve, right? Third month in a row kind of makes a trend. Do you think that Fed officials are going to be willing to call this seasonal and think that maybe they can, the economy can handle a cut?
Well, I think when you look at the underlying data that we got today and its implications for PCE later in the month, I do think that it will cause the Fed to kind of say, look, I mean, this could be a trend. We don't know. There's a lot of uncertainty in the economy. When we look at the underlying data that the Fed likes to look at, this is the core services metric, ex housing. This has been accelerating on a 6-month average basis. So I would suggest that they're going to say, maybe we need to see another 3-4 prints before we really get comfortable with the underlying trends here.
There's inflation, but the other side of this is the jobs data and the economy, kind of proof that higher rates aren't actually as restrictive as many had thought. So do you think that there's a need to front run and perhaps cut to make sure that we get a soft landing?
It's a really difficult question to answer because the Fed is really trying to thread the needle here. I think back to the 1970s, which was the last time the Federal Reserve cut interest rates prior to inflation getting back down to their 2% target. What happened? Inflation return hit double digit levels. Paul Volcker stepped in, raised the Fed funds target rate to 20%. 20%. We think 5.25% is restrictive. Can you imagine 20%?
Yeah.
That killed inflation, but it also brought on a recession. That's what the Fed is trying to grapple with right now.
That's good perspective. But I want to ask you about the equity reaction, right? Since we saw that 10-year auction, markets are at session lows, and they've been pretty resilient so far to rising bond yields. Has the character of the market changed?
I don't think so, but I do believe the market's got a bit ahead of themselves this year, pricing in the perfect execution of a soft landing by the Federal Reserve, which I don't think we're at that point just yet. But there are other areas of the equity markets that are going to continue to move higher, regardless of when the Fed cuts interest rates for the first time, such as artificial intelligence. An advisor asked me the other day, what inning are we in the AI boom? And I suggest that we're only in batting practice of a doubleheader. There's so much more opportunities that lie ahead in data centers, in software and hardware, and of course, in semiconductors and chips.
Well, I usually sit in San Francisco, so that's very much the message there as well.
Understood.
Matt, I want to ask you, though, do the Fed minutes matter as much? We're going to get them in less than an hour. And has there just been so much data and so much Fed speak as well between that last meeting and where we are now? How much weight should investors put into those minutes?
Well, I mean, these minutes obviously were crafted well ahead of the CPI report. And so I would suggest that the market's going to be more focused on the PPI numbers that we get later this week, the final implications for our PCE report at the end of the month, and ultimately what that may mean for the Fed and its decisions when it goes into the May meeting. And so I think that this minutes will be taken with a fair bit of salt there. And just people will say, you know what? Let's just focus on PPI tomorrow. That's what they'll focus on.
Absolutely. Kevin, you just mentioned the AI trade.
Yes.
It actually, over the last few weeks, it's been losing a little bit of steam. We've seen NVIDIA enter correction territory, but it's up today, kind of defying the broader markets.
Right.
Where do we go for the rest of the year? Do you think that we continue to see that broadening out of the rally among other equities, or is it still the mega caps? Because they're in a way very defensive with their huge cash piles and their leading positions.
Yeah, we saw last year that the Mag 7 accounted for 62% of the total return of the market. Now it's down below 40%. So the rally is starting to expand. But for it to really expand, we need the Fed to start cutting interest rates, and we need continued signs of moderating inflation. I don't think we get that to the second half of the year. But AI will continue to grow, and people are going to continue to invest in the AI ecosystem regardless of interest rates. We learned Microsoft is investing over $2 billion in data centers just this week. We saw that Digital Realty had announced a joint venture with Blackstone to build over 10 new data centers. And then, of course, we're hearing all this news on the chip side and the money that Taiwan Semiconductor just got as well.
I spoke to Google's cloud chief, Thomas Kurian, last night, and he has big plans in the cloud as
well.
So they're certainly spending. Just lastly, put this sell-off into perspective for us, because I know we're going to talk to someone later on in this show who says that we should be seeing bond yields even higher and equities should be down even more. Is this almost a healthy reaction to potentially lower, less cuts this year?
I believe it is. I think there can be more short-term bouts of volatility ahead as everyone continues to play the Fed guessing game that we've been doing during this discussion as well. But if you look a little bit longer term, D, 2-3 years out, it's hard to make a valid argument that rates, yields, and inflation won't be lower. And if those three things are the case, well, then opportunities in both stocks and bonds, notably municipal bonds, start coming to the forefront.
We talked munis yesterday. Matt and Kevin, thank you very much for being with me today.
Thank you.
Today's spike in the 10-year Treasury yield, it's pushing up mortgage rates and hitting home builder stocks. Diana Olick has the details here. Diana.
Yeah, that's right, Deirdre. The average rate on the 30-year fix jumped nearly a quarter of a percentage point this morning following the hotter-than-expected CPI report. We're now at 7.29%, and that's the average. It's the highest level since the end of November. It had crossed over to 8% in October briefly, which was the highest in a few decades. Now, the home builders are taking it on the chin, of course. The home construction ETF, ITB, falling below its 50-day moving average, down over 3% on the day, but still up about 6% year-to-date and a whopping 57% year-over-year. Just a note, ITB includes not just home builders, but home remodeling names like Lowe's, Home Depot, and Sherwin-Williams. Big builder names like D.R. Horton, Lennar, and KB Homes are all dropping below their 50-day average. And, of course, mortgage names like Rocket and United Home Wholesale Mortgage are also seeing the hurt. Rocket Mortgage down more than 11%. I would also note that REITs are also having a particularly rough day across all REIT sectors after outperforming yesterday. REITs are particularly rate sensitive given how commercial real estate is, of course, financed. Back to you, Deirdre.
Dan Olick, thank you very much for bringing us that. And coming up, a C-suite view on the health of the economy from the head of trucking firm XPO. Shares are coming off of their best year ever. And now the company is adding even more capacity as a result of Yellow's bankruptcy arrival. We will look at what it means for the state of freight. But first, Lyft CEO David Risher is wrapping up his first full year on the job. Shares are up 80% under his tenure and outperforming Uber by nearly 2-1 over the past 3 months. After the break, we'll check in with David ahead of his first anniversary as CEO and look ahead to what's next for the ride-hailing company. And as we head to break, here's another check on the markets with the Dow still down more than 550 points, though off session lows, and the 10-year yield still above 4.5, 4.564%. The Exchange is back right after this.
This is The Exchange on CNBC.
At the UPS Store, we know things can get busy this upcoming holiday. You can count on us to be open and ready to help with any packing and shipping or anything else you might need.
Is there anything you can't do?
Actually, I don't have a good singing voice. The UPS... Nope. But our certified packing experts can pack and ship just about anything.
At least that's good.
The UPS Store. Be unstoppable. Most locations are independently owned. Product, services, pricing, and hours of operation may vary. See center for details. Come in today to get your holiday goodies there on time.
What's on the horizon for financial markets? At PGIM, it's a question that over 1,400 investment professionals relentlessly research in pursuit of your long-term goals. Specialized across asset classes, but united in collaboration, our teams provide global and local expertise. Our investments shape tomorrow, today. Pursue your tomorrow with PGIM, a leading global asset manager.
Welcome back. Shares of Lyft are up around 80% since David Risher took the helm almost a year ago. They're still underperforming Uber during that time frame, which has seen shares more than double since last April. But over the last 3 months, a different story. Shares up nearly 40%, beating those of Uber. Joining me to discuss his first year at the helm and his renewed focus on the core business is David Risher, CEO of Lyft. David, great to see you at One Market, feeling a little homesick.
Deirdre, it's not the same without you. Where are you?
It's also the location. We sat down for our first interview right when you took this job a year ago. My first question to you was, what would you do first as Lyft CEO to turn things around? You said you wanted to be competitive again. How have you been?
Yeah. Well, you know what? We've been growing every quarter. So up 10%, 17%, 20%, 26%. And that kind of growth is because our customers, our riders, and our drivers are loving what we've done. So I'm thrilled to see that. We got a lot more to do, but I'm super excited about the first year.
In terms of market share, have you guys been able to strengthen your position? And part of that was making Lyft more competitive against your rival Uber in terms of pricing, in terms of driver supply. Any metrics you can share on that front?
I mean, look, when I started, you know, I said we weren't really going to focus just on market share. I think we were maybe in the high 20s at that point. Now we're sort of in the low 30s. My bigger focus is on, you know, Women Plus Connect, online pickup promise at the airport, you know, 70% driver earnings guarantee. These are the types of things, the features and the services, as well as good pricing, fast pickups, that drive our, you know, our share and our business every single day. When riders do better, when drivers do better, we do better.
Right. And what you've kind of described has been your overarching strategy of doubling down on your core, which is ride sharing, new products and features. We have a graphic we can show you, our audience, all the things that you've implemented. That's also helped you and the company get closer to break even GAAP profitability. Does that continue? Do you continue to make that the priority in year two? Or do you start to think about investment again, expanding beyond the core?
You know, so my thesis is customer obsession is what drives profitable growth. Customer obsession drives profitable growth. And so the more we obsess over our riders, the more we obsess over our drivers, the more we're going to grow. And I love seeing the growth we've got. We've got good growth in the United States. We actually are seeing, we're just sort of on a tear in Canada, which is wonderful to see. That's an area of expansion for us. So that'll be the sort of investment we make, is continuing to invest in products and services that drive more loyalty, drive more preference for Lyft.
Right. So, David, today we're watching markets sell off on hotter than expected CPI data. What are you seeing from your customer, the Lyft riders? Are they taking on more or less rides, premium or lower priced shared rides?
Yeah. So we're in a quiet period right now, which, you know, frustrates me. It's not my go-to place. So I can't say too much about it. But what I can tell you is I like what I see. You know, we for example, this past weekend, Eclipse weekend, it was a big deal for us, right? You had millions of people across the United States, you know, kind of moving into position. Love that. We have more drivers than we've had, I think, in the company's history, certainly since pre-COVID. We're seeing really good growth. So not seeing a lot to worry about there, actually nothing at all. But to be honest, if people are worried about pricing, we've got a great product called Wait and Save. Allows you to save a little bit of money if you want to. But that's haven't ever really seen anything to worry about.
Okay, and David, talk a little bit about supply, because I know that this is just such an important part of the equation that as riders we don't always get to see, but that's been a fierce competition just in this industry of ride sharing. How have you been able to boost Lyft supply?
So I love that you're asking this question, and let me be super clear. When we talk about supply, which sounds sort of technical, we're talking about how many drivers choose us every single day. We have over a million drivers on their platform in the last year, which is amazing, really significant part of the economy, actually. And they make, by the way, about $30 an hour after their expenses. That's sort of after you know, gas and maintenance and so forth, per engaged hour when they're on the platform. So the first most important thing is you've got to make sure the drivers are paid fairly. And that's what we did when we instituted something called the 70% earnings guarantee, which means we'll always take, they'll always make at least 70% of what a rider pays after certain fees. So when you ask about driver supply, you're really asking, you know, are we doing a good job attracting drivers, retaining drivers? And again, we have more drivers than we've ever had. So it's a great story, and I'm super proud of it.
Last question for you, David. Regulatory threats. I've covered the industry for a long time. They always seem to bubble up, but they're not always front and center for investors. Because also you've been successful so far in keeping drivers on as contractors, not full-time employees, which would change the business model. But you're facing off with regulators in Minneapolis, and you and your rival have threatened to actually leave the city if it doesn't go your way. Is that still the case? Are you optimistic that you'll reach some kind of agreement there?
I'm super optimistic. And we've actually put forth, you know, in fact, actually the state of Minnesota has put forth what we think is a reasonable bill. Look, this is the thing. I know people talk about our threats to leave. I don't even consider it a threat. It's simply we're not going to put a service in place that just is a bad service. And a bad service means one that's overpriced, where drivers actually make less because fewer riders want to take you know, a Lyft. So I'm just not willing to do it. If you're a customer-obsessed company, you don't work in a place where you can't, you know, deliver for your customers, your riders and drivers. Having said that, I actually think that we're going to come to a good point. I certainly hope so.
And David, there's a lot of anecdotes about ride sharing becoming more expensive, just on kind of like this yearly trend. Does the data support that?
Not significantly. I mean, like anything else, we have costs that increase. You know, our insurance is up a little bit, like everybody's is, and so on and so forth. But honestly, I mean, we're talking about something that's in the $15 to $20 range. You know, you were talking about builders before and, you know, and sort of mortgage brokers. That's a whole different level. We're talking about a daily purchase for a lot of people that's well within people's budgets, mm-hmm. and we're not really seeing a big change there.
Okay, well, David, thanks for being with us. Hope to talk to you year two also, and see you back in San Francisco. David Risher, CEO.
I'd love it.
Of Lyft.
Thanks, Deirdre. Really appreciate it. Thanks.
Coming up, Alphabet's annual cloud computing event is underway, and I sat down exclusively with Google Cloud CEO to talk about the landscape and the AI arms race. We will bring you the highlights and look at whether Google is in the midst of a strategy shift when it comes to those competitors. As we had to break, here's another check of on the markets. They are now well off session lows. The Dow is down now only about 400 points. It was down more than 550 not too long ago. The exchange is back right after this.
At the UPS Store, we know things can get busy this upcoming holiday. You can count on us to be open and ready to help with any packing and shipping or anything else you might need.
Is there anything you can't do?
Actually, I don't have a good singing voice. The UPS... Nope. But our certified packing experts can pack and ship just about anything.
At least that's good.
The UPS Store. Be unstoppable. Most locations are independently owned. Product, services, pricing, and hours of operation may vary. See center for details. Come in today to get your holiday goodies there on time.
Welcome back to The Exchange, everybody. I'm Tyler Matheson with your news update at this hour. Former President Donald Trump says Arizona's ruling on abortion went too far. The state's Supreme Court ruled yesterday a near total ban on abortion from the Civil War era was enforceable. Trump predicted Arizona's governor and others will bring the law, quote, back to reason. It comes after earlier this week, Trump issued a video message saying he thinks the issue of abortion should be left up to the states to decide. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, meantime, signed a domestic violence bill inspired by the killing of Gabby Petito today. The bill, referred to as the Gabby Petito Act, would require law enforcement officers to conduct a lethality assessment when investigating alleged domestic violence incidents. And it was inspired by Petito, who was killed by her fiancé in 2021. And the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers posted on X images of the remnants of the Francis Scott Key Bridge following its collapse on March 25th. The images were captured using an underwater sonar tool called Coda Octopus that's used primarily as a survey tool by divers. Salvage efforts have continued since that bridge's collapse. Wow. Weeks away, obviously, D, from clearing that channel.
That's
back to you.
Quite the imagery. That's underwater we're looking at.
Really amazing.
Tyler, thank you.
See you
soon. Coming up, an inside look at the state of freight from the CEO of trucking firm XPO. That's next, with shares up 300% over the past 12 months. And here's a look at the names hitting new 52-week lows today, including Starbucks, Biogen, Boeing, Charter, and Walgreens. Walgreens is hitting its lowest level since 1998. You can see broader markets still underwater. The exchange is back right after this. Welcome back to The Exchange. XPO shares trading near an all-time high, and they have surged more than 300% over the last year. The less-than-truckload operator benefiting from rising prices in that segment of the market following the bankruptcy of Yellow last year. XPO is reopening one of the service centers purchased from Yellow's liquidation today. Joining me now to discuss is XPO Chief Executive Mario Herrick, along with our Frank Holland. Frank, take it away.
Deirdre, thank you very much. Mario, good to see you as always. I know it's a big day for XPO. It's also a big day for the economy. I want to start off about asking you about that hotter than expected CPI report and the fact that it may be putting some questions out there about whether or not we are going to get rate cuts. How does that impact your business? How does that impact the business of some of your customers, like an Ulta Beauty, a Ford, or a Jeep?
Well, overall, rates being high, Frank, lead to lower economic activity overall and in a slower economy. And we see that cost inflation in our business as well. But for us, given all the great work we're doing for our customers and given the state of the less-than-truckload industry, where historically we haven't had as much capacity, a lot of that cost inflation that we see in our business, we end up passing to our customers as well. But we'll see what the rate environment does. We're seeing the environment being stable, slightly improve as well where it was in the fourth quarter. And it's tough to call what the macro would do over the next couple of quarters here.
What about the rise in oil prices that seems that will translate into higher gas prices? How does that impact your business? And again, the willingness and ability of your customers to ship freight?
Yeah, so for gas prices, typically when we bill our customers, there's a mechanism where we bill what we call a fuel surcharge, or we pass on the fuel price fluctuations back to the customers. So typically when the fuel prices are higher, the customers pay a higher amount on their bill, and when it's lower, they pay a lower amount on their bill. So we as a company are not as impacted by it. And now, that said, for our customers, what customers value is great quality service. They want to make sure that we can pick up the freight on time, deliver it on time, and deliver it damage-free. And we have been delivering record levels of service levels, which means our customers want to give us more market share. They want to give us more freight to make sure they can get the great service that we are offering them as well.
All right, Mario, it's great to get your insight into the economy. Let's get to your business right now. As I mentioned, it's a big day for Yellow. You're opening up one of those service centers that you purchased from the Yellow liquidation there in Nashville. Talk to me about how that's going to help your business. I'm looking at less than truckload rates. Since we first heard about the possible bankruptcy of Yellow, they've spiked about 50% since then. How's that benefiting your business?
Yeah, so first, starting on the service center, it's a great day for us here in the greater Nashville market. We just opened up this week a facility here north of Nashville in Goodlettsville. We just had the ribbon cutting this morning here. And what that means is more capacity to be able to service our customers. And the immediate benefits that we would get, one is a service benefit. By having more dock space and larger facilities, we can offer better service for the customer. And the second one is an efficiency benefit. For example, here in Goodlettsville, we used to dispatch drivers up to an hour from Nashville to pick up and deliver freight in Goodlettsville. And now they're driving 5 or 10 minutes to get to the customer location. So that leads to higher efficiency and better service. And on the long run, we're investing in capacity in growing freight markets like here in the Nashville area. And this will enable us to handle more freight over the next 10 plus years to come.
You're also looking at cross-border traffic, specifically moving freight from Mexico as part of nearshoring into the U.S. Looking at the latest figures, in February, a 13% rise in cross-border freight movement from Mexico. You also, in this liquidation purchase, you got a service center near the Mexican border. Talk to me about reshoring and your business when it comes to that.
Well, Mexico is a very important market for us. And as you said, Frank, there's a big trend in what we see, especially with industrial companies, is nearshoring their manufacturing. So they're either moving manufacturing to Mexico, somewhere in the U.S. or in Canada. And today we can cover all of Mexico, we cover all of Canada. And one of the service centers we bought is in Nogales, Arizona, which is right across the border from Nogales, Mexico. And we already have customers lined up where they're moving some of that freight from Mexico into the U.S., and they'll be able to leverage that new facility. And for Mexico specifically, today we have 7 border crossing locations. These are areas like El Paso or Laredo or Southern California, where we can support our customers' needs as they need shore more of that manufacturing. We can help them move that freight here within North America all the way to Canada and vice versa.
You know, not only are U.S. companies looking to Mexico to move operations and manufacturing, Chinese companies are as well. Obviously, a lot of news this week with Secretary Yellen in China. One of the things she said is that these Chinese companies, they can sell their EVs here in the U.S. I'm just curious, have you heard more from Chinese companies that are looking to nearshore closer to the U.S. market?
Predominantly, our customers are North American customers. Today, we service more than 30,000 companies across North America. We haven't heard a lot of Chinese manufacturing moving over to the U.S., but what we've heard more of is existing customers that are U.S.-based companies that are moving their manufacturing plants from Asia or other places here, either in the U.S. or in Mexico or in Canada as well.
All right, Mario Harik, your share is up 300% over the last year. Congratulations to you. Deirdre, back over to you.
Great interview. Thank you, Frank Holland, and your guest, Mario Harik. Coming up, chipmakers are among some of the biggest drags on the NASDAQ 100 today, but NVIDIA is managing to buck the trend. Morgan Stanley upping its price target, saying business continues to strengthen. One trader says shares are defying gravity. He will tell us whether it'll come back to Earth or if he thinks there's more room to run. That's next. And here's one more check on stocks. They're heading back towards session lows. You can see the Dow Industrials is down about 550 points. The Russell 2K is getting it the hardest. And the NASDAQ Composite is a little more resilient than the other major indexes, but just barely. The 10-year is still above 145. We're back right after this. We're keeping an eye on markets, and all three major averages are down over 1%, while the 10-year climbs back above 4.5 after that hot inflation print. But my next guest says he's surprised stocks aren't under more pressure. Joining me now is Jeff Kilburg, KKM Financial founder and CEO, and a CNBC contributor. Jeff, you say some odd stuff is happening. Explain that to me.
Deirdre, a lot of cross currents in the marketplace today, but to your point, I have to go back to my bond leadership. I cut my teeth in this business trading futures in U.S. Treasury pits in Chicago. And when you see a 20 basis point jump in that 10-year note after a lousy auction, on top of the fact that CPI did come in hotter than expected, I do see resiliency. But what's really odd to me is that the VIX is only above 16. And then you see NVIDIA. NVIDIA has turned into a safe haven. Yes, Deirdre, a safe haven, it seems like, as we're seeing sellers booking profits, but they're still piling in NVIDIA. So I do have a little bit of concern about the backbone of the leadership we've seen in NVIDIA. So if you look on a chart here, because I think it is defying gravity when you look at a technical chart, that 50-day moving average, Deirdre, is $50 lower. The 200-day moving average is $300 lower, down around 558. I don't think NVIDIA goes down there, but when you see technicals line up like this, I think that $800 level is coming, and that could change the sentiment, and that could move the VIX higher and cause a little bit deeper of a pullback around 49.50 in the S&P 500.
Jeff, when you look at the fundamentals of an NVIDIA, though, it's a very different picture, right? It's just had blowout quarter after blowout quarter, making that valuation actually seem more reasonable, even as the stock has become more expensive on an absolute basis.
Unequivocally, and I think that's the last $500 in NVIDIA. I think it's interesting, yesterday you see Intel come out. We didn't get a pricing on their competitive chips, but they talked about being a fraction of the cost and more efficient, nearly 50% more efficient. We didn't really see a move off of that. So I understand that NVIDIA is the leader. I have exposure. I'm still long NVIDIA, but we do have a hedge in place using options to overlay our position because I do have concern that's been too much too fast. But today is just a really interesting example when you see the market's pulling back and NVIDIA up almost 2%.
Right. But Intel versus NVIDIA to me is like apples to oranges, right? Intel is trying to catch up, whereas NVIDIA.
Well, we're still talking fruit, though, dear Jen. I think at the end of the year, you are going to see some of that market share. It's very simple. If you have orders with NVIDIA's chips, if you have a small deposit down there and you're going to get presented an opportunity to buy those chips at 50% less, you're going to cancel your order. That's just the way
if
the
market works. If you think
NVIDIA is
a chip company, but increasingly it's a software company, it's an ecosystem, and that is helping hold on to its dominance. But Jeff, let's get off NVIDIA. What does it tell us about the broader markets? I mean, as we head into this period of more volatility, when there's questions about the number of interest rate cuts, if any, when there's questions about commodities and inflation, do you go to those defensive market leaders like the mega caps that carried the markets last year?
I think there's bifurcation, not right now, but I think there's a lag effect. And you are seeing some of these names still defy gravity. But when you see the move in 10-year note, we haven't seen the 10-year note up at this since last October. When you talk about the last October, that sentiment, that mindset was that we had 6 rate cuts coming in 2024. I think they've all been taken off the table. The Fed, this isn't an outlier number in the CPI data, Deirdre. We are seeing 3 consecutive months of hotter than expected inflation. I think the Fed's handcuffed here. Therefore, that 10-year note up here, there's going to be a lag effect. We're seeing 30-year mortgages move higher. There are ripple effects. We can't just have these yields move higher and no effect on equities.
Right. And I know you're looking at the VIX, which has been under 16 after the CPI. Does that show complacency or resilience? Is that sort of the distinction that you're making? You think there's more pain ahead?
Yes. And look, I've been cautiously optimistic. I was a lone bull in 2023. So I think we have to get through this pocket of volatility. But the VIX at 16, that's historically low. If we go back to where the VIX has been, we haven't seen it above 25 in a year. We have to go all the way back to October of 22. When we saw markets in turmoil to see the VIX above 30. So I think there is a spike in volatility coming short term. And I think it's going to be bought with the $6 trillion on cash. But right now, I think you have to buckle up your chin strap.
Okay. Jeff Kilburg, always great to get you insights. Thank you. KKM Financial. Coming up, Google might have taken a few stumbles out of the AI gate, but after his keynote at the annual Cloud Next event yesterday, one exec called out both Microsoft and Amazon while touting Google's proprietary offerings. We will hear more from my exclusive interview with Google Cloud Chief Thomas Kurian next. And before we head to break, take a look at some of the fintech names. They're under pressure today as investors expect sticky inflation to keep rates higher for longer. Affirm is the biggest laggard. It's down by more than 6%. SoFi Technology is also down nearly 4%. We'll be right back. Welcome back to The Exchange. Stocks, they're still under pressure, drifting back towards session lows. We've got the Dow down about 525 points with that 10-year yield still above 4.5. Earnings is going to kick off this week, a new catalyst. That'll start with the banks. And then we've got big tech a few weeks later. Investors will be watching cloud computing numbers very closely as a barometer of enterprise spend. And they'll also be watching a new battle in the cloud wars, one where access to the best AI models and tools is now key. Google has long been a pioneer in Gen AI, began developing the technology years ago, had the best talent, but it hasn't been as aggressive with that messaging as rivals like Microsoft and its partnership with OpenAI. On the consumer side, strategy remains uncertain. There were controversies surrounding its image generator and, of course, that innovator's dilemma we're talking a lot about facing its core search business. But on the enterprise side, Google can afford to go on the offense, and that is happening right now in the cloud. I sat down exclusively with Google Cloud CEO Thomas Kurian on just those issues. Take a listen.
We vertically optimize, but we are open and offer choice, which means we're not a closed system. We're not trying to lock people into our tools and technology. We allow people to use it in exactly the way they want to. And they have the choice of models, they have the choice of tools, they have the choice of chips, they have the choice of many other elements. And so that's part of our success has been providing this open platform. At the same time, deeply integrating the pieces so that people get performance, scale, security, reliability.
How is that different than what other hyperscalers are offering?
Well, one of them's offering a closed system. They have one model, one provider of that model. They don't even own that model. The other one does not have any AI expertise, so they only offer third-party models. We blend both. We have our own models, and we have the expertise to build systems and integrate these models into our products so that people can use it. At the same time, we're not taking a closed proprietary point of view. When we say vertically optimized, we don't mean vertically integrated equals a lock-in like another provider. We're also monetizing AI in a variety of different ways, you know, for the startups and the people building foundational models. They get to use our infrastructure and pay us for the use of that infrastructure, just like the way they used to pay for classical computing. People who use our models pay us for the use of our models and our tools.
Is that replacing spend in other areas or at other cloud providers? Is that new spend from them?
It's new spend. And in many cases, it's doing something they could not do before. I'll give you an example. We process over 1 million calls for one customer every day using our customer service AI. And if you think of a human being answering those calls, they can do about 100 to 200 calls a day. That's a lot of people they would have to hire. Now, the reality is they wouldn't be able to staff such a large organization, and those calls are not being answered. So now that they're able to do that using our customer service AI, they're able to solve a problem they couldn't do before. It's net new spend for us. It's giving their customers better customer experience, and that in turn will drive monetization for them.
Obviously, Google has had the talent in this race. But when it comes to Anthropic, and you made a mention of your rival who's working with a closed source model, Google was first to work with them. And then Amazon came in with a big investment. And can you explain to our audience how that works? Why you guys didn't lock up Anthropic, for example, in the same way that Microsoft sort of locked up OpenAI, or did it? And how that relationship works?
So Anthropic started with us, and they are still a very close customer and partner of ours. They train their models, serve their models. We've integrated that into our AI platform, something we call Vertex. We're actually giving our technology along with Anthropic to many customers. In fact, we have meetings today with, along with the Anthropic team, with several customers to show people how they can use Claude, the Anthropic model, on top of our platform. So alongside Gemini, we do that too. We've never wanted to say, if you want to serve a model through us, you'd have to be owned by us, or you'd be tethered to us. And so we give model providers, whether they're open source companies like Mistral or Llama 2 from Facebook or Meta, we give them choice of where they want to run their models. And if we do an exceptional job, we'll get more customers using our platform along with their models.
So both Google and Amazon, they've announced multi-billion dollar investments into that Gen AI startup darling Anthropic. But what I hear is that the partnership could be more important to an Amazon than a Google, because Google has its own foundation models like Gemini and its open source version, Gemma. Amazon doesn't, of course, and Anthropic's model, Claude, is a big name to show its cloud customers in a similar way as Microsoft doesn't develop its own model but uses OpenAI's ChatGPT and different tools. Before we go, there is still time to register for the inaugural CNBC Changemakers event in New York City on April 18th. We will hear from some of the women transforming business, including Commerce Secretary Gina Raimondo. To request an invite, you can scan the QR code on your screen or go to cnbcevents.com/changemakers. You do not want to miss that one. And that does it for the exchange today. Market expectations for a June cut are fading even further after inflation came in hotter than expected. We will get insight into the Fed's thinking with the minutes from the last meeting. That's just moments away. Tyler's getting ready, and I will join him on the other side of this break.
You've been listening to The Exchange. Make sure you're subscribed to get each episode every day, same time, same place.
Sometimes it takes a different approach to help you unlock your true potential. With Capella University's game-changing FlexPath learning format, you gain relevant skills you can apply to your career right away. Earn your degree from an accredited university and be confident in the quality of your education. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu. Capella University is accredited by the Higher Learning Commission. Learn more at capella.edu/accreditation.